Welcome.
Stand and welcome.
Hello, good evening and welcome
to Discovery.
Discovery.
Listen to Discovery.
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 Sounds like a lot of fun.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now.
Now, to the speeded up brain of the user, that sound lasts for 4 hours and sounds like this.
Discovery.
Welcome to Discovery, the National Science Radio Show, coming to you from the studios of 2ACR and broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. Today's show explains the ins and outs of podcasting and looks at the prospect of super-fast broadband through clever scratches on glass. I'm Matthew Francis, and joining me in the studio we have Chris Stewart, Noel Hannah, Ian Wolfe, and our producer, Jackie Pepper. First up, we have Noel with the news.
First, eyebrow-raising research from a group from the Department of Plastic Surgery at Johns Hopkins University in the United States. The group, headed by Dr. Jeffrey Schreiber, published a paper in the Aesthetic Surgery Journal, more on them later, which detailed the results of a 100-person survey where participants were asked to rank the attractiveness of photos of people's eyebrows. The eyebrows deemed most attractive were measured, for example, the distance between the center of the eye and the middle of the eyebrow, and the results averaged to deduce the ideal proportions. They say that beauty lies in the eyebrow of the beholder. Now imagine that you were one of the first humans to migrate to the island of Madagascar around 2,000 years ago. The island was alive with megafauna, the pygmy hippo, the elephant bird, and giant lemurs. These animals were at the top of the food chain, that is, until humans arrived. Ventura Perez was the head of a group of anthropologists who have shown that the extinction of these animals was most likely due to hunting for food by humans. Looking at the bones of the animals, clear evidence of butchery was seen. Now, to give you an idea of what these animals were like, the elephant bird was a 3-meter-tall, 500-kilogram dinosaur-like feathered animal, which laid 30-centimeter eggs. And the giant lemur was a descendant of the was a precursor to the modern-day lemur. Now, the modern-day lemur, the heaviest sample of one of those is around 7 kilograms, whereas the choice of food for the early migrants to Madagascar was a 90-kilogram gorilla-sized animal. I wonder what they tasted like. Moving from taste to smell, computer scientists at the University of Guelph in Canada have been putting neural networks to an interesting use, modelling the intensity of odours from pork farms. With the encroachment of residential areas on previously isolated farms in many countries, the adverse health effect of pork farm odour emissions has been the subject of some concern. Pork farmers, looking at ways to mitigate these odours, have turned to computer science. A neural network is a computer model that's inspired by the human brain, in which several interconnected elements process information simultaneously, adapting and learning as they go. In this case, the levels of ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, the temperature, time of day, and month are used to predict the intensity of odours. Apparently, this is the most successful model made so far. Thanks, guys. Finally, bored of your coffee, waiting for something new to come along that is both caffeine-rich and icy cool? Well, soon you won't have to make do with an iced coffee because those folks at Nestlé have got something even better up their sleeves. Nestlé have applied for a patent on a fermented coffee beverage. The idea is to roast coffee beans to extract the flavour, then begin to ferment them. The fermentation process is stopped before any alcohol is made, resulting in a frothy beer-like beverage with a coffee aroma and fruity or floral notes.
Thanks, Noel, for the news. You're listening to Discovery. And now, Chris, tell us about this lightning-fast broadband.
Well, I've been doing a little bit of research on this over the last couple of days, and I actually have to admit some of the research came and found me,
which is the best kind of research, I reckon, where you don't actually have to go out and look for it. You just trip over it. But I've been looking into modern communication networks. Now, as broadband is becoming more and more the norm, we're all taking advantage of the fact that we've got the ability to download enormous quantities of information and send emails around the world before we've even thought about what we're going to say. And a lot of this works because of this wonderful thing called the optical fiber. The long-distance communications, you know, between Australia and the rest of the world or across this great wide brown land of ours, a hell of a lot of that these days is done through optical fibers. And so the information is being sent as light rather than as electricity. But it's only when you start having communication networks operating at the speed of light that you realize just how slow normal communication devices are that run on electronics. And it's got to the point now where the interface between the optical part of the communication network and everything else, the computers, the devices that run on electricity, is actually a bottleneck. It's slowing everything down. We're not being able to take full advantage of this wonderful optical technology. And so a lot of effort's being put in research centres all over the world trying to figure out how can we make fully optical devices. So an optical computer that uses light rather than electricity, an optical telephone, an optical iPod, all of these sorts of things. So I've found two recent pieces of research, pieces of discovery that have bearing on this next step in communications technology. The first one comes out of IBM. A bunch of clever chaps over in their research labs in the US have come up with a bit of a photonic chip. It's not quite your Pentium processor yet. What they've managed to do is to slow light down when they shine it into this little silicon chip, which is a pretty clever thing to do because light being light, it travels very, very quickly. And if you want to do anything with it, you've got to contain it and manage to switch it backwards and forwards and do the sort of processing that you need to do. So these guys have figured, well, one of the best ways to do that is to slow it down. And they've come up with a chip that slows it down by a factor of about 300. So it's still going incredibly fast, much faster than the electricity normally would be in your Pentium processor, but slow enough so that they can actually start to think about how to use it for things like memory, switching around to process different signals and so on. And they've done this in a very clever way by mixing together two different devices. One device, which would normally be the size of a room, which slows the light down, and the other device, which is the silicon chip waveguide. So that's a really nice little advance there that they got over at IBM. That's the one that I actually went out and found, the piece of research that I found. The one that I tripped over is actually going on down the corridor from my office at the University of Sydney. A group of guys called QDOS, the Centre for Ultra High Bandwidth Devices for Optical Systems. How's that for an acronym? They've come up with a very clever thing. It's a piece of glass with a scratch on it. But that piece of glass with a scratch replaces entire big cabinets full of couplings between optical fibers and electronic equipment that help you amplify and clean up a signal as it travels across the world. So let me tell you a little bit about how this works. And in order to do this, I'm going to need the help of everyone else here in the room. So can we have all microphones on, please? Okay. Normally, we'd be doing this with light. That's a bit hard to show you over the radio. So I'm going to mimic the effect of the QDOS little device by using sound. And remember, sound is a wave, light is a wave. The analogy's pretty good, yeah? So this is what the QDOS guys have done. They've got a piece of glass with a scratch on it. But this isn't just, you know, running a razor blade over a piece of glass. This is a very carefully engineered scratch. You shine the light into the piece of glass through the scratch. And it does a very clever thing. What it does is it separates the signal, which you want, from the noise that you don't want. As any signal travels across the world, it picks up all sorts of noise, and so we want to get rid of that. So, Noel, can I have an example of a signal? Can you give me a tone, please? Thank you very much. That's our signal. Can I get Matt and Ian, give us some noise, some white noise. Very nice. Can I have them both together, please? Okay, we just want to get Noel's signal and get rid of the noise. Well, what happens in this piece of glass is that it's what's known as a non-linear crystal, and that's going to change the frequency. So what that means is it's going to make Noel's note higher in pitch. So can we have noise and higher pitch, please? But it only changes the pitch if you're nice and loud. And so because the noise is a little bit lower in volume than Noel's note, it doesn't get changed in frequency as much. So then what you can do is put this through a filter, which gets rid of all of the low notes, which is essentially the noise. So can we have noise and note again, please? And then we get rid of the noise, and then we take it back down to the original frequency, and we've got our signal. So these guys have come up with a piece of glass with a scratch on it that manages to do that completely optically, so they can get rid of this bandwidth bottleneck, and we're one step closer towards the optical revolution in communications technology.
Well, thank you, Chris. Now that we're hopefully going to have all this super fast broadband, later on we're going to see just what you can do with all of that download that you can now do.
Una notte a Napoli, con la luna e il mare, ho incontrato un angelo che non poteva più volare. Una notte a Napoli, delle stelle si scordò, e anche senza ali in cielo mi portò.
Volando lontano dalla terra, dimenticando le tristezze della sera, in paradiso oltre le nuvole, pazza d'amore come le lucciole. Ed in cielo mi ha abbandonato. Adesso sulla terra son tornata. Mai più riamare mi sono rassegnata.
Ma guardo su.
Quanto tempo può durare? Quante notti da sognare? Quante ore, quanti giorni e carezze infinite? Quando ami da morire, chiudi gli occhi e non pensare. Il tempo passa, l'amore scompare.
Una notte a Napoli, mi portò.
Il cielo mi portò.
In cielo mi portò.
Il cielo mi portò.
In cielo mi portò.
That was Una Notte a Napoli by Pink Martini. You're listening to Discovery, and now to podcasting and podcatching. All the hip kids are doing it, and for all I know, you're doing it as I speak. Ian Wolfe now explains what it means and how it works.
Radio on demand, TV on demand, demand on demand. Download everything you want to see and hear whenever you want it, wherever you want it. This is the promise of podcasting, the community networking of Web 2.0. Most podcasting is currently in the form of MP3 radio shows, but any kind of media at all can be podcast. And it's not just a game for people who own Apple iPod music players. MP3 is a way of compressing sound files to be 20 times smaller by throwing away all the frequencies that your ear and brain can't hear anyway. It stands for Motion Pictures Expert Group Compression Standard 1, Layer 3. If you were to send photos, you could use JPEG on a network like Flickr.com. JPEG is Joint Photographic Picture Expert Group format. If you sent video, it could be an MPEG 1, 2, or 4, or something called DivX. There are many different compression schemes being used. If your sound or video player can read it, then you can play it. So, how does it work? Well, it starts with someone producing content, say a community radio science show. After the show is recorded and saved as an MP3 file, it's uploaded to a web server, such as ourmedia.org. Anyone can now surf to that page and download the file. Then a text file is written in the extensible markup language XML, describing where the file is, how long the file is, which is called an enclosure, and details about what is in the recording. This file is now part of RSS, really simple syndication. Syndication is making media available to many places at the same time. The listeners now engage in pod catching to search out and subscribe to download the podcast that they want to hear. You can use a web browser and just click on the MP3 links, or you can use an RSS newsreader program, or you can use automated software like iPodder. iPodder and other automated software is designed for people who want to regularly download the shows they love to hear, such as a weekly science show, without having to remember anything. The software has the web address of the podcast RSS file called the feed, and it starts up in the middle of the night and downloads all of your favourite podcast radio shows when they're new since the last time the program was run. It downloads them in the middle of the night because MP3, being a 10-year-old compression scheme, makes for large files that take time to download, even on broadband. Next, you can listen to your downloaded MP3 shows either on your computer or, more comfortably, on a standalone MP3 player. If you have an iPod or other flash memory-based music player, you can set iPodder to load the podcasts onto your machine in the middle of the night, ready to be listened to on the way to work or school. If you have a DVD player, most of them double as an MP3 CD player. Just try it out. So you can burn the MP3 files to a data CD disk, then lounge in front of your TV and play the shows on your DVD player. Many new CD players now come with the ability to play MP3 files, and some are even multi-codec, like iRiver. A multi-codec player can not only play MP3 compressed files, but sound files from Windows, such as WMA, or standards such as MPEG-2, MPEG-4, WAV, DivX, or Ogg Vorbis. Now, if you don't have a DVD player or any other form of standalone MP3 player, you can still just burn the shows as an ordinary audio CD and then play them on your stereo system. If that's too hard, you can just listen on your computer. Many people have been downloading TV shows from overseas that aren't on their local networks using the BitTorrent file sharing system. And this has been incorporated into RSS, so you can podcast large files very quickly. Apple have released an iPod that shows their own format of video on a tiny screen. But of course, you can always transcode your videos from whatever compression format they come in into video DVDs to play on any DVD player. You're not trapped at your computer. All of the media is to go and podcasts are free. Discovery is podcasting as we speak. We have around 50 shows available for download. This may be the future of broadcasting and narrowcasting. No need for commercial network programming guides. Just download your shows direct from the producers. The Comedy Central Network in the US is releasing the very wonderful Jon Stewart's The Daily Show this way. It's a totally legal download with the permission of the producers and the network. The Daily Show is topical comedy about the news of the day, so the producers hope you'll buy their books and maybe their DVDs for big events like the US elections or their intelligent design debate. It's all very new and most of the shows are non-commercial and very raw and fresh. It's breathed new life into community radio and TV. Anybody with a microphone can make their own radio show. Anybody with a video camera can start their own TV show. You can get podcast-safe music that doesn't infringe copyrights at websites like podsafeaudio.com. There are podcast directories like podcast.net that list some of the shows you can find. Apple's iTunes has a podcast directory for you to choose free content from. And Australian websites like the iPodcastNetwork.com are working at a way to make a buck from it without selling porn.
That was Ian Wolfe with A Wonderful World of Podcasting. Now, to listen to the Discovery podcast, simply set your internet device to look at feeds.feedburner.com/discoveryradio. You're listening to Discovery, the National Science Radio Show. And now, finally, we have some speed science. First up, Noel, what have you got for us?
Oh, well, this is a little thing I found when I was researching the Aesthetic Surgery Journal.
It's always a good read.
Yes, it is. I compiled a list of titles that I thought were maybe something that we didn't actually want to make into the news.
Now, can I just say this, but this is a bit of a cheap shot. Because, you know, you could go and look at, you know, nuclear physics and come up with a whole bunch of stuff that no one's ever going to understand the title of. But some of these are rippers, really.
They are. I mean, okay, firstly, from, I think it was this month's Aesthetic Surgery Journal, there was the Abdominal Contour Surgery for the Massive Weight Loss Patient, the Fleur-de-Lis Approach.
Now, I'm intrigued because, like, does everyone know what a Fleur-de-Lis is? It's a shape, right?
Yes.
It comes from, it's sort of a stylized flower. And it basically looks like a three-pronged fork. I mean,
would you like to know what the fleur-de-lis approach is?
Please
I could
do.
Actually,
yeah.
I think that the shape, the fleur-de-lis, actually refers to the shape of the cuts they make in the patient's stomach.
Nice.
And then sort of fold inwards to get rid of the excess.
Origami.
something
origami
like that.
Origami for big people.
Yes. Then we also have things like blending the lid-cheek junction.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
Elevating the mid-face with barbed polypropylene sutures.
That's got to hurt.
Sounds like a fishing accident almost.
That's a bit.
Facial reshaping using less invasive methods.
Okay, what's the more invasive method? That's what
Perhaps the next one will answer that. Lateral open forehead lift.
Ow.
And my favourite, balloon-assisted endoscopic brow lift. Preliminary experience.
We're going to come back and do more of this, but this is just a preliminary look at doing this nasty surgery.
Yes.
Okay, Ian, what have you found?
Well, they've been looking at the brains of pathological liars and people who are just normal folk, and they've found that the pathological liars have less white matter in their brains.
So doing brain scans on these people.
Brain scans, exactly. And these people have less, and of course, apparently, the white matter is also where they think people determine right from wrong.
How do they get people for these kinds of studies? Do they put up signs saying, "Are you a pathological liar? Come and help us with our research."
And if you say no...
are you in or out? I can't figure it out.
It's one of those things I'd like to find out myself. I wanted to find the paper, but I couldn't find it on the net.
So if you're lying your teeth off, then you've got less brain.
Less of the white matter and more of the grey matter, perhaps. Oh. A different balance. But it means possibly they could actually scan for the people with less white matter.
So this is the new polygraph?
Perhaps.
Yeah. They could just lock people away preemptively.
That's
just,
right.
Just thing scan, is, scan everyone.
Well,
at birth
preventative and detention yes. of potential suspects.
I can't exactly. tell you where I am, but I can tell you I'm safe. What it comes down to.
Only one of you.
Yes.
Unless you're under a control order.
Unless you're under, yeah, true.
Right, well, Noel, what else have you got?
There's also a bit of news about a former museum chief who was found guilty of 12 federal crimes in America. Basically, he was convicted of selling government property, which was actually bits of the NASA spaceship and other little, you know, bits of the moon and all sorts of things that they're actually supposed to remain property of the American government.
So this guy, he's a curator of
he
museums?
Is of some kind of space a museum of space artifacts.
So
I think
he's just wandering out the back and going, "Ooh, moon rock. Yeah, I could sell that on eBay."
Something like that. Yes.
What's his defense?
I think he was a bit confused and he didn't. He didn't know which ones were his and which ones weren't.
Not enough white matter in the brain.
I think that's probably what it is. Yes, it's the not enough white matter defense. I went to the Science Museum in London a couple of years ago. And, you know, I've been to many museums in my life. And you'll wander around in your average museum and go, ooh, stuffed owl, you know, oh, exciting. And in the Science Museum in London, you're wandering around and you're going, oh, look, it's a big replica of the re-entry module from the Apollo space mission. No, it's an actual re-entry module from the NASA. Bloody hell, that's really cool. I wonder if he's flogging that kind of thing.
Oh, quite possibly.
If you can pick it up, you can take it.
Yes, I think so. But so he's he could be imprisoned for up to 5 years and fined $250,000.
Goodness me.
Wow. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Been listening to Discovery, the National Science Radio Show. Today you've been hearing from Chris Stewart, Noel Hannah, and Ian Wolfe. Today's show was produced by Jackie Peffer, and I'm Matthew Francis. If you'd like more info on today's show, you have a nagging question about science, or just want to say hi, drop us an email at discovery@2ser.com. And of course, if you want to grab our podcast, go to feeds.feedburner.com/discoveryradio. Discovery is recorded at the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney and is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network.